Better?
Yes.
Labyrinth and the auction for the tote bag were the things that I was bringing to your attention. After we have been hearing from our first two wonderful speakers, there's going to be a time for us to ask some questions. And hopefully more than just this mic will work, because we have mics set up in this section, and this section for you to use. If you really wanted to use a mic with the musicians, they might let you come stand there too. But we have these three places set out. Rachel, what were the other announcements?
I only
heard the ones you're giving. Labyrinth and the tote bags. Tote bag. And the caucus groups. Sign up for caucus groups. Those are at the registration table also. Those will be happening. Some of them will be happening during workshop time. I see one is trying to get together during a lunchtime. So you kind of have to pick your own place and time that you're going to gather with whoever else is interested in drawing a caucus around a particular theme or concern.
And refreshments.
And refreshments. Thanks. There are refreshments. If you go through the vendors and go keep going and you get to food, you'll know that you've gotten to the refreshment spot. There is coffee and juice and tea and yogurt and fresh fruit and wonderful pastry donuts and the naughty things up there already that will be refreshed for our breakout time this morning and some new things put out there. So please, if you're hungry, go and get it there. I think that's it with, come on. Bet. I'm seeing my other two tri-chairs there, Jeannie and Rachel. I've introduced us as the maid, the mother, and the crone, and you guys can figure out which of us is which. This is the maid, this is the mother, and I'm the crone. Thank you.
It's been fun, and we just have been looking forward to your being here.
And we say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
You missed that part of it, but enjoy what's here.
At this time, then, I would like to introduce our first speakers, Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Ann Parker. I met Rita about 9 months after the first reimagining when she was doing a course at United Theological Seminary on third world womanist, and I can't do Spanish very well, Mujerista. Christology. And I was able to tell my committee at the Presbytery that wanted me to know that I was taking a Christology course, that yes, I had taken a Christology course. While we were meeting, the Presbyterian General Assembly was going on, and we were watching Rita get interviewed at the same time that we were having this class. It was just another remarkable memory from 1993. The memory that I have from that class is that Rita announced the first day of class that she likes to live the theory that she has of feminist approach to life by offering the class to select what grade everyone would get. They all get the same grade. Now, this was a room full of about 80% women, 20% men, all pretty liberal theologians. And it took us from Monday to Thursday to decide that we were all going to get an A. Some of it, I think, was age, because she said her college-age students had no problem figuring that out the very first day of class. thoroughly enjoyed that class. I also wanted to lift up some metaphors that I have of these two women last night when we were gathered together in circles and sharing our water stories. And I ran across the room and butted in and said, I've got to introduce you tomorrow, so I want to get some juicy stories from you. No, just some wonderful things. And talked about their stories of water. And Rita had told a story about being in Puerto Rico and being out on a night when there was a new moon and the water was fluorescent and being able to pick it up and let it spill down like diamonds. And that has been my sense of some of the gifts that Rita gives to all of us, are those diamonds that sparkle. And Rebecca talked about what was going to be a wonderful, gentle canoe ride down the river that turned into a day-long, life-harrowing experience in southern France. And my sense of Rebecca is that that's a very good metaphor for a lot of your life, too, of thinking that this is going to be a gentle thing that we're doing and then finding out it's a lot harder than we ever expected. And she left us with this wonderful metaphor of what it's like to get through rapids. You either get through rapids eloquently or inelegantly. She said that holds true for much of life.
But you get through them.
You do get through. You do get through. So I would like you to welcome Rita and Rebecca.
A beautiful day, which we are going to experience through our imagination, which is completely capable of extending beyond the roof and walls of this building to experience and know the whole world. Well, Rita and I are really happy to be here, and we wanted to mention at the outset one of the secrets of feminist theologians' lives. One of the secrets is that we spend a lot of time on our research and our writing, and we actually argue over punctuation when we're co-writing. The biggest question when we're getting ready to do a public presentation conversation like today is, what to wear? And we always try to find something for each of us to wear that's gonna just kind of complement one another or coordinate. But this is the first time that the whole room is coordinated with us. So thank you for that. We're going to begin with about 40 minutes of material that we have planned to present to you. We're going to read a little from our book, Proverbs of Ashes, and we're going to share with you some of our most recent research for a book that we're currently writing. And after the formal part of our presentation, then we want to open the floor for you to speak, not just to ask us questions, because if you ask us questions, we'll answer them. We'll go on and on, and we'll keep answering. But more than that, for all of us to have an opportunity to speak in response to the ideas and thoughts we're going to share, for you to tell another story from your life if you'd like, or offer a reflection, or add to what we've had to say, or witness to something that you feel called to witness to.
We were both here in 1993. And it's great to be with you all again. We've been back for several of the others, but it's especially important for us to have been at this one, and we're really appreciative of the invitation to be here and that you're all here. It just feels good. One of the changes since 1993 is I have to wear reading glasses. As Rebecca said, what we're going to talk about today is partly from material for a new book we're working on. Part of that work is research into Christian art. And since we couldn't show slides in the round, we brought just a few things that we put up on the whiteboards with some commentary so that you have some samples of things that we're talking about in our talk today. The first reimagining in 1993 was one of the first major World Council of Churches events after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Once the evil empire of the Cold War collapsed, the religious right substituted us. Feminists, lesbians, women of color, you know, as the new evil empire. And they came after us with a vengeance. But their action was a little like closing the barn door after the horse had escaped. Most of us had been writing and working in feminist and womanist theology and church politics for a decade or more, some of us for several decades. Feminist womanist work was and is widely read around the world, and we continue to thrive because we know we are right. And we are in this for the long haul. For the rest of our lives,
yes,
for our lives' sake. On and on for the lives of women to come, you're right, and for our foremothers and sisters. Recently, Osama bin Laden took us out of the crosshairs of the religious right guns by attacking the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Now, Islam has become the new evil empire. Though, Jerry Falwell actually tried to link us up. When he claimed the attack was caused by feminist lesbians and homosexuals. It's sort of like Bush claiming that Iraq was harboring Al-Qaeda operatives. We live in a different political world than we did in 1993. Much has happened in the last decade that concerns us. We know, Rebecca and I, that we do not need to remind you of all the ways women and children around the world are threatened, not only by war, but by first world economic policies and its use of the environment. We know we are with people this weekend who care about what is happening and who are working to reverse great harm. For that, we are deeply grateful. What we want to tell you this morning is that though the world has changed, we were right at the first reimagining. We were right about Sophia, and it was wonderful to hear the song again. We were right to celebrate her. She has been and will continue to be a major figure in Christianity. The greatest cathedral in all Christendom, Saint Sophia, was built in her honor in the 6th century, as were many beautiful churches dedicated to her throughout Christendom. And we have a book about Saint Sophia back there if you'd like to browse through it. That great cathedral still stands in Istanbul, where from the 15th to the 20th century, it was a mosque. The Muslims so loved the way it looked, they made it a mosque. And they respected it as a house of God. Its architecture was so admired that the Ottoman Muslims had their mosque in Istanbul built by the same kind of architecture. Today, it is a museum for both Christianity and Islam. Last July, Rebecca and I stood in the breathtaking, magnificent space of St. Sophia. We spent hours admiring its stunning beauty. Its enormous central dome gave the impression both of soaring upward and of hugging the ground. For all its great weight and size, the stone dome in the middle of the massive octagonal sanctuary seems to float on top of the huge marble pillars supporting it. And in its apse is a mosaic of the Madonna holding her child, flanked by guardian angels. As we stood facing the apse, Rebecca and I were discussing the fact that the altar area of the cathedral was a little skewed, like not centered. And we were speculating that it must be oriented toward Mecca and had been rebuilt by the Muslims. A slender young woman wearing a long-sleeved blue blouse, long gray skirt, and ivory headscarf interrupted us in English and explained that mosques have an orientation toward Mecca, which is the direction all Muslims must pray. She explained the duties and rituals of Muslim prayer and why it was important to do them. We appreciated her thoughtfulness. We discovered she was from Kuwait. We had a lovely conversation with her about religion. Then she asked, "Who is this Sophia person?" Little did she know she'd asked the right people. Two feminist theologians. We explained that Sophia was not a person, but an aspect of God's presence in the world who guides our lives. This surprised and intrigued her. So we told her a little more about holy wisdom. We mentioned the Hebrew word in Proverbs, chokmah. She smiled and said delightedly, "Oh, we have the same word in Arabic, hikmah." As we chatted, she shared her extensive travel plans, which included England and Germany. She was only in Istanbul for 5 hours, so she had decided she must see the great Hagia Sophia. As we were winding down our conversation, she declared with a broad smile, "I have no husband to tell me where to go." "So I am free to go where I please." Rebecca thought she meant she had a husband, but he wasn't with her. I thought she meant she wasn't married and was delighted to be single. In any case, we said, "We also have no husbands and are traveling many places," at which we all laughed and wished each other safe travels as we continued our separate experiences of St. Sophia. In the wake of September 11th and the war against Afghanistan, it felt right somehow to have such a delightful moment with a Muslim woman within the embrace of Holy Sophia.
I'm turning to the left. Another thing we were right about at the first reimagining was to reject the doctrine of the atonement. In 1993, several addresses at reimagining critiqued the theological claim that Jesus' death on the cross saved humanity. We don't need all this blood and sacrifice. We don't need an atonement at all, Dolores Williams said. Her comment was reiterated by the religious right as a sign that feminist and womanist theology most assuredly had to be stopped. But the importance of this critique has only become clearer over the past 10 years, especially now as our country's Christian president has relied repeatedly on violence to save us. During its first millennium, Christianity believed that the resurrection saved us. The cross was a ubiquitous image in Christian art during these 1,000 years, but it was always a resurrection cross. It appears blossoming into a spiraling green tree, issuing forth the four rivers of paradise flowing into the River Jordan, bursting into a sun at dawn, or glittering in a midnight sky filled with gold and silver stars. But Jesus does not appear on it dead. When Jesus appears on the cross, he is alive. Often, for example, standing on a platform in front of the cross with his arms raised in a prayer position that indicates he is standing in paradise and is victorious over death. The oldest surviving monumental images of Jesus dying on the cross, the oldest surviving one in Western Europe, comes from the north, from Saxony, at the end of the 10th century. The emergence of the dead Christ as an icon for Christian meditation marks a shift in Christianity towards the sanctification of violence. Before the 10th century, Christianity maintained that violence, while sometimes justified, was always a sin. Soldiers who killed in war had to do penance, even if they fought in a just war. But in the 10th and 11th centuries, Europe experienced a social breakdown into lawlessness and chaos. In the breach, bishops began to call peace councils and recruited armies to defend the church. In November 1095, Pope Urban II called a peace council in Clermont, France. Preaching to a gathering of armed nobles, bishops, monks, and laity, he called them to turn aside from fighting each other and take on instead the noble mission of fighting against the enemies of Christ in the East. Pope Urban, Penny Cole comments, argued strongly for the unprecedented and extraordinary character of the war which he was proposing, one instigated by God, in which the combatants were not plunderers, but soldiers of Christ, fighting not improperly, but rightly, and whose reward was not to be a few coins, but eternal glory and friendship with God. As preparation, they were to receive by Christ's command the remission of their sins. Thousands responded to Urban's sermon by taking the cross. In public rallies, they vowed to give their lives in the service of God's honor. At first, however, they did not travel east. They traveled north to the Rhineland and began to hunt down and kill Jews. A medieval Hebrew chronicler tells what it meant when a preacher of the Crusades arrived in Trier during Passover. The chronicler's ancient words: when he came here, our spirit departed, and our hearts were broken, and trembling seized us, and our holiday was transformed into mourning. The Crusaders killed approximately 10,000 Jews in the Rhineland in the spring of 1096, nearly a third of the Jewish population in Europe, and the first massive massacre of Jews by Christians. By 1099, the crusading Christian armies had reached Jerusalem. The account of their conquest of the city by Raymond of Angoulême witnesses to the extent that violence in the name of God led to atrocities. This is a contemporary account. Listen to these words. Piles of heads, hands, and feet were to be seen in the streets of the city. Men rode in blood up to their knees and the bridle reins. Indeed, it was a just and splendid judgment of God that this place should be filled with the blood of unbelievers, since it had suffered so long from their blasphemies. Unquote. Some accounts put the death toll in Jerusalem at 40,000 killed in 2 days. A Muslim chronicle from this period tells of refugees from the atrocities in Jerusalem arriving in Baghdad during the holy fast days of Ramadan. It describes the weeping in the mosques as the refugees' stories were told. The chronicle reports that the distress of the refugees was so great, they were relieved from observing the fast. With this first crusade, war became a Christian way of life, the fastest route to salvation. Holy war, with its invention of genocide, became a new Christian idea. Anselm of Canterbury, Pope Urban's friend, provided the formal theology that captured the spirit of the age. Writing in 1098, in the midst of the First Crusade, he produced Cur Deus Homo, Why Did God Become Human? The first full-blown explication of a substitutionary theory of the atonement. Anselm interprets Christ's death on the cross as recompense to God for humanity's debt of sin. Jesus' execution is a gift that liberates humanity. Anselm wrote, "Man absolutely cannot give himself more fully to God than when he commits himself to death for God's honor." Unquote. Anselm exhorted Christians to imitate Christ's self-offering when the cause of God's justice demanded it. He made the resurrection and the life of Jesus unnecessary. Sacrificial suffering and death had now become the means of salvation. In Anselm's theology, God was honored by Jesus' crucifixion. The boundless merit of Christ's substitutionary suffering blesses all humanity. With this theology, Western Christianity turned toward divinely sanctioned violence. Violence was no longer a sin that required penance. Christian holy war was itself regarded as a penitential act. The fastest route to paradise was to kill or to be killed for Christ. Self-sacrifice became the highest love. Death by torture became salvation. And God took pleasure, it was imagined, in the murder of human beings deemed evil.
We'll work it out.
Tomas Mosnak is a scholar of the Crusades. He sees in the First Crusade a blurring of boundaries, a failure to distinguish realities. It was as if a hypnotic, seductive veil had been dropped over the eyes of the most faithful Christians. The church confused temporal and eternal peace. In calling the Crusade, Urban confused heavenly and earthly Jerusalem. Likewise, the acts of violence committed by the Crusaders confused the historical actors who killed Jesus with 11th century Jews in Europe and with the Muslims of the East who lived peacefully with the Christians of the East. Eastern Christians opposed the Crusades and were also killed because they got in the way as the Crusaders marched to Jerusalem. The church confused the mystical body of Christ with the literal body of the dead Jesus. Studies of violence show that extreme violence blurs boundaries. Present realities substitute for other realities. The target of violence stands in for someone or something else. Time merges, people merge, places merge. War, in particular, fails to distinguish realities and excels at false identifications. War creates meaning by the force of false associations that have come to seem completely rational. The substitutionary theory of the atonement generates a series of substitutions. Crusaders slaughtered Jews as substitutes for Muslims, who were substitutes for the Jews accused of killing Christ. The Jews substituted for the Romans who actually killed Jesus. Jesus substitutes for sinful humanity to pay the debt owed God. God substitutes for Satan as the cause of Jesus' death. Personal suffering and self-sacrifice substitute for the moral virtues of self-restraint and serenity. And committing violence substitutes for spiritual rebirth as the route to paradise. Such theology, like violence, obliterates distinctions and replicates itself indiscriminately. Afghanistan can substitute for Al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein can substitute for Osama bin Laden, who can substitute for Hitler. Iraq can substitute for Afghanistan. All Muslim men can substitute for terrorists. And as we have seen, Muslim men can substitute for lesbians, feminists, and people of color. Who can substitute for communists? The substitutionary theory of the atonement puts life at risk. The emergence of this theology in the 11th century, along with the emergence of the crucifix as an image for devotion, marks the beginning of a 1,000-year period in Western history dominated by the confusion of violence, self-sacrifice, and love. The inability to distinguish among them haunts us still in legacies of war, terror, and abuse. So, we were right to reject any theology that makes violence a way to save the world, even the violence done to Jesus. And this is the third thing we were right about in 1993. our focus on life. During the first 1,000 years, the church did not focus on atonement. The idea of a sacrificial mass that celebrated the death of Jesus did not develop until around the time of the Crusades or even later. Until then, the Eucharist was a feast of the resurrection, in which the Spirit was called down upon the whole community to sanctify it, so that they could commune with the beloved departed resting in paradise, with the risen Christ found in the bread and wine, and with each other as saints of God. The most important ritual of this time, however, was not the Eucharist, but baptism. As birth began the journey of earthly life, baptism began the journey toward becoming divine. By descending into the grave, Jesus defeated sin and evil. When he rose on Easter, Jesus unlocked paradise, closed after the banishment of Adam and Eve. His blessings were conferred through the Holy Spirit via baptism. Baptism was performed for all at Easter dawn, after adult candidates undertook lengthy austerities that took as long as more than 3 years. At their very first Eucharist, the newly baptized had fasted for 8 weeks of Lent. To break that, and the bishop fasted with them, by the way, to break that fast, they were first given a cup of milk sweetened with honey to confirm the freedom they had gained. Baptism was called rebirth, which is why early images of Jesus' baptism show him as a small child, and why images of him with his mother as a baby were so common. Newly baptized adult catechumens were called infants. And by the mid-5th century, mausoleums and baptistries shared the same rounded or octagonal architecture. The idea of crossing the River Jordan and being baptized in its waters symbolized baptism as new life, as a journey toward God and a spiritual home.
Baptism conferred upon reborn Christians the wisdom needed to live grace-filled lives. Baptism was, as Rita said, a rigorous process taking 2 or more years in which a person was reshaped, body, mind, soul, and spirit, into a new being. It was the granting of a new life, a rebirth in the spirit. Through baptism, Christians entered upon a process called theosis, or becoming divine. Baptism conferred the protection of God's Spirit upon the baptized, who then took on the responsibility of increasing the power and presence of that Spirit in their lives, a process of becoming divine by incarnating Sophia, wisdom. In our own search to construct theology not centered on the atonement, we wrote Proverbs of Ashes. We wanted to witness from our own lives to the power that gives life and repairs it, We'd like to read you now two stories from the book.
The Japan of my childhood was ruptured by violence. At the end of World War II, every Japanese citizen was expected to serve the country, to rebuild it from ruins and humiliation. My mother, who was 17 at the end of the war, had wanted to be a physical education teacher. Instead, she volunteered for Red Cross training and English lessons to become a nurse in a U.S. military hospital in Fukuoka City on the inland sea near the shore of Hakata Bay. A 20-minute train ride from Fukuoka City, my grandparents' thatched roof farmhouse faced the mountains across the valley and sat on the outskirts of the village of Onojo. A gravel path led through the entry gate, which was surrounded by a profusion of pink and magenta azaleas in spring. The path curved gracefully up to the granite flagstones laid before the weathered sliding door. I lived there for most of the first 2.5 years of my life. Until I was 5, my Jichan, grandpa, and Bachan, grandma, cared for me while my parents worked in Fukuoka. Bachan was from Saga, Japan. Though only about 50, she was stooped over from years of hard work. I spent so much time with her my first 5 years that I spoke Japanese with her Saga accent, unlike my mother, who spoke Fukuokan Japanese. It's sort of like living in New York and speaking as if you were from Mississippi. Jichan kept a store in the village and a garden at home. He was a lay preacher at his Jodo Shinshu Buddhist temple. He wrote poetry and was a quiet, reflective man in a house of garrulous women. He was my bathing partner every evening because he bathed first in the cleanest water. I was the youngest and only female grandchild and the only child living in my grandparents' house. After dinner, Bachan warmed the ofuro, a large deep metal tub with a wooden bench inside it. The tub sat in a wooden hut against the back outer wall of the main house near the kitchen. Bachan filled the tub with water from the backyard pump and started a fire under it. After my mother scrubbed me clean, I was handed to Jichan in the steaming tub water. He held me in his lap so I wouldn't fall in over my head. As we simmered, we talked. When we finished our long soak, we put on our cotton yukata. Jichan slipped me inside the top of his above the belt and carried me around his garden, murmuring to me. My body was hot from the ofuro, as was the skin on Jichan's chest. Against my arms, I felt the soft, dark blue of his yukata next to my pink and white one. My hair was wet. I could hear Jichan's low, hoarse voice above my head as he walked around the garden. The fall evening air was cool and refreshing after the bath. When I looked down, I could see the tops of his beautiful mums. I could smell their pungent odor as well as the fragrance of the last of the roses. I remember the silence as I slipped into slumber every night on my futon next to my mother, with Jichan and Bachan in the next room, separated by paper walls. The night stillness was full of presence.
I felt my warm body against the cool cotton covers. I heard my mother's soft breathing as she lay beside me, and I sensed my grandparents nearby. Swaddled in silence, I felt safe, loved. The same quality of silence accompanied Ji-chan and me as we played in the main room of the house. Sometimes he sat beside me, focused and watching as I played with an origami toy he had made for me. Other times, he used his hands to throw shadow animals that danced on the wall to my delight. In those moments, I felt him more present to me than when he spoke. Words were the leaves rustling on the surface of the ground, and silence was the root network of love. Deep, solid, and inexplicable, a presence both elusive and tangible.
To survive the painful experience of Frank's sadistic abuse, I constructed an intricate set of internal walls within myself. On one side of the thickest dividing wall lived my well-adjusted self, competent, kind, high-achieving, creative, and thoughtful, my father's daughter. On the other side lived the unblessed child, and the child left for dead in an inner series of rooms more and more carefully closed and sealed. The internal silences I created replicated the public silences. What my community could not name, it could not see. And what the community could not see, I could not integrate. My religious community, most of all, could not see violence against children because it could not name clearly the violence that happened to Jesus. The challenge for me, as for many survivors of sexual abuse, was to find a way beyond the possibility of healing and wholeness to its actual realization. Facing the horrors of the past was not enough. The violence was in me, in my body, in my impulses, in how I had constructed my internal domain. It was mid-spring 1997. Suddenly I felt I simply could not go on. Suicidal despair haunted my days and nights. I wanted silence. I wanted stillness. I wanted a sanatorium or a retreat. I had to get out of where I was. I called the chair of the school's board of trustees, Arliss Unger, and said, "I need to take a break from the school." "When?" she asked. "Before the semester is over." "How long?" she asked. 10 days, maybe 2 weeks," I said. "The school will be fine," she said. "We'll take care of things. Arrange to go at the end of this week." I left everything. I got in the car and drove north to the city of 10,000 Buddhas. I called the head of the university there, who was a friend of our school. "I need to take refuge," I said. "Of course," she said. "We'll make a place for you." "What is the fee for a person to make a private retreat there?" "Fee?" she said. "We do not charge a fee. Make a donation if you would like." One of the Buddhist teachers escorted me to a tiny cottage in the woods. "This is your space. What else do you need?" "I need silence," I need to not talk to anyone. No problem, she said. Here. She handed me a small, worn plastic badge in Chinese. The Chinese was translated in parentheses, not talking. I grinned. You are used to people not talking here. Of course, she replied. I went into the little cottage and spread out the things I had brought with me. All of the drawings I had made since beginning therapy, drawing paper, pastels, ink, colored pencils, watercolors. I brought the cello in from the car and set up the music stand with Bach's cello suites open to the G major suite. I got out photographs I had brought of everyone I loved and arranged them on a small altar. I placed on the altar a tall votive candle that I'd bought at the Mexican grocery just outside the entry gate to the city of 10,000 Buddhas. It only cost a dollar. On the front was a stained glass picture of an angel guiding two small children across a raging torrent of water. I lit the candle and went outside for a walk. The city of 10,000 Buddhas had been created from the abandoned buildings of a former state hospital for the insane. It was out in the country, east of Ukiah, in a northern California valley among the lush coastal hills. It was early spring. The new grass was tall, tender, bright green. The grounds were going wild with overgrown trees. The fields were blooming with daffodils and tulips run riot. Peacocks lived there, harbingers of the pure land. Their fanned tails shimmered like a pond of jewels. A hill rose behind the buildings, where one could walk through pine woods along the edge of a vineyard. In the distance, the hills rose more steeply, dark blue against the clear blue of the spring sky. I took deep breaths of the cool air and went back to the cottage. I began to draw. Over the course of 10 days of silence, I made a series of drawings in which I pictured my body being cut open. Inside the length of my torso was an old, huge, gray penis around which my body had grown like a tree grows around a stone. Using pastels, colored pencils, and watercolors as my surgical tools, I removed the old penis from the inside of my body, cutting all the blood vessels that had grown like roots around it. An empty cavity was left. The patient looked like she might die on the operating table. I took needle and thread, deep red thread, and sewed through the paper to sew her body back together. Every afternoon, I walked for hours through the fields and forests that went on for miles beyond the city of 10,000 Buddhas. The day the penis was removed and the cavity lay open, I walked the farthest, venturing across fields, then up into the hills, following a stream. In the late afternoon, far away from any visible human activity, I came to a grove where the warm sun slanted through the oaks and dappled the grass along the water. I stopped. I lay down in the tall, sweet grass for a while, feeling the warm earth underneath me. Earth, heal me, I said. Then I rose, took off all my clothes, and waded into the water. A small cascade of white water crashed over the rocks and swirled into a still pool. I crouched down, feeling the cold water rush around me. Then I moved my feet forward into the soft mud on the bottom of the pool. Slowly, I turned and lay down in the water, letting my whole body sink beneath the surface to rest on the mud. I relaxed the muscles holding up my head, and the water closed over my face, cool and still, lapping quietly. In a few moments, I jumped up. It was too cold to bear for long. I felt at peace. I smiled to the sky and the trees, to the green pasture and the still waters. Surely, goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life.
Surely, goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life. Early Christians would have heard this phrase, in this phrase, their salvation in paradise. Early Christians believed Jesus welcomed them to paradise, just as he promised one of the thieves crucified with him that they would be in paradise together that very day. A place relieved of hunger, sorrow, persecution, violence, and death, a place of plenty and peace, was the gift delivered by Christian baptism. Paradise had an earthly address in the east. It was, of course, where the dead entered to await the last judgment when they would also be resurrected into heaven with Jesus. But paradise was not heaven. It was a waiting room, a place to rest, and a place that allowed the living to commune with the beloved they had lost. Because of its earthly location, paradise was also found in this life, granted with baptism. Paradise was the living of a sanctified life in this world, a life that grew in wisdom as those born of water and spirit came to know the divine spirit incarnate in all the world. This knowing of spirit brought a deeper understanding of this world and gave a new meaning to life and all its relationships. Early Christians depicted paradise with pastoral scenes, the four rivers of Eden flowing into the Jordan. They showed flower-dotted hills, emerald meadows, fruit-laden trees, vineyards, and dolphins and fish frolicking in crystalline waters. Early images of paradise convey the world of the viewer, neither perfect nor unusual, except as it is made numinous by the Spirit. And I just want to describe for you an image of this in San Vitale, a 6th century cathedral built in Ravenna, Italy. It shows Moses the moment he has heard the voice say, "Take off your shoes, you are standing on holy ground." And he's bent over, untying one of his sandals, and his head is turned up to the hand of God coming to him from the sky, and he's looking there. And in front of him, below the hand of God, is a bush that's aflame. All around him is an emerald meadow. And all over that emerald meadow are bushes on fire. Dolphins, as a symbol of the Christian soul, are among the most common images as they wait to rescue Jonah from the whale, as they watch the disciples fish, or as they leap in sheer joy. Sometimes risen saints, martyrs, and virgins stood in paradise landscapes that look a lot like the world the people lived in. Jesus Christ commonly appeared in these pastoral scenes as the Good Shepherd.
The ancient bishops, when they baptized the elect, offered prayers of life. And we'd like to close this time by reading you some excerpts from some of the early Christian prayers and sermons. At the moment of baptism, first the bishop would address those about to be baptized, explaining something of the meaning of what was about to happen as they descended naked into the water. And then
oiled up too.
Oiled, naked and oiled into the water, which were in pools in the center of the round baptismal buildings. And then there would be a prayer over the sanctification, to sanctify the waters. So here's one of the sermons, an excerpt from a sermon and one of the prayers. God has looked upon your tribulations, which you were previously undergoing, and had mercy upon you because you were for a long time captives of the tyrant and served a cruel servitude to him. He saw the number and the nature of the calamities which you have endured, and this moved God to deliver you from that servitude and from the great number of your ancient tribulations, and to bring you to freedom, and to grant you to participate in the ineffable heavenly benefits which immediately after you have received, you become undoubtedly free from all calamities. It is now time for you to receive deliverance from your ancient tribulations and enjoy the good things that have been shown to you. And then this prayer over the water. For the sanctification of these waters by the indwelling power of the Holy Spirit, let us pray that the Lord may send upon them the grace of redemption, the blessings of Jordan. Let us beseech the Lord.
Lord, have mercy.
That they may avail for the cleansing of the souls and bodies of all who draw and partake of them. Let us beseech the Lord.
Lord, have mercy.
That those who are baptized therein may appear as the lights of heaven, being delivered to paradise. Let us beseech the Lord.
Lord, have mercy.
Great art thou, O Lord, and wonderful are thy works, and no words are sufficient to sing thy wonders. We praise thy name, O Lord. Amen.
Bishops delivered sermons such as the following. And why, some will say, if the bath takes away all our sins, is it not called the bath of the remission of sins, or the bath of cleansing, rather than the bath of regeneration? The reason is that it does not simply cleanse us of our faults, but it does this just as if we were born anew. For it does create us anew, and it fashions us again, not molding us from earth, but creating us from a different element, the nature of water. You have read about water. They indeed were in the beginning of creation, but for you it was reserved for water to regenerate you into grace, just as waters generated other creatures unto life. Imitate the fish, which indeed has obtained less grace, yet should be an object of wonder to you. It is in the sea and is upon the waters. It is in the sea and swims upon the floods. A tempest rages in the sea, storms shriek, but the fish swims. It is not submerged because it is accustomed to swim. So, even for you, this world is a sea. It has diverse floods, heavy waters, and severe storms. And do you be a fish, that the water of the world may not submerge you. Baptism transmogrified the world. From its careworn, often discouraging, fatiguing, and sometimes dangerous daily routines, ordinary life was lifted into transfigured space, a miraculous affirmation of what waited beyond death because it had already come after baptism. The love of God conferred the power to overcome evil and death, to see beyond the thin veil of sorrow into paradise, not in an extraordinary utopia or glorious other world, but in the ordinariness of this world, lifted by divine love. All our loves, lifted by divine love. So here we are again in reimagining paradise, in the space we create with each other, the space of Sophia. Blessed be. For some conversation together. Who would like to say something? Or sing something? Come on up to the mic
there,
so we can all hear you.
I loved your book, Proverbs of Ashes, and I particularly loved your personal stories that made it all come to life and come together. However, at the end of the book, I was left wanting more, which is good. The more that I wanted, however, was a substitute for the atonement theory. And I wonder, I'm hearing this morning that that substitute may be baptism, but I've also felt very called in the past several years to a renewal of the Eucharist. And so I'm wondering if that's possible, and if you would speak to that.
Sure. Well, we briefly alluded in the talk to the theology of the early Eucharist, and I think the latest book on this is by Andrew McGowan at Episcopal Divinity School. That's 2002, I think, Oxford Press. Study of, it's called, I think it's Aesthetic Feasts or something like that. We had been doing a lot of research on the meaning of the Eucharist because the crucifixion isn't a central idea in salvation in the early church. I checked the research with him because it was a surprise to me, being a low church Protestant who doesn't study all of this, that the idea that the body and blood of Christ on the table signify the sacrifice of Jesus is very late in Christianity, maybe 13th century. And the Eastern Church never had it. It still doesn't have that theology. And that, in fact, the Eucharist was called the Feast of the Resurrection. And so the body and blood represent not the presence of the death of Jesus, but the presence of the risen Christ, who is with the community because of the Holy Spirit. So the The early prayers, what they're called the epiclesis prayers, the prayers that bring the Spirit down into the community to sanctify the feast, the Spirit was called down not into the bread and wine, but into the whole community. And that meant that the whole community was sanctified by the Spirit and then could participate in a feast, not only with the risen Christ, but all the dead in paradise. So it was a feast that celebrated ongoing life with death in the midst of it. They did the words of remembrance because Jesus had asked them to do the words of remembrance, so that's in the Eucharist prayer, but it's in there with a bunch of other things. It's not the central moment of the Eucharist. So the Eucharist itself was not a celebration of the death of Jesus. It's clearly not an atonement theology that drives the early Eucharist. And it's wonderful if you go to the catacombs in Rome, which I'm sure a lot of you have been to see the drawings of the Eucharist in the catacombs, because they look like raucous parties. There's one of seven women, and one of them is yelling to a servant, "Get us some more, bring it warm." The words are actually written there. And there's one carving, I think it's on the side of a sarcophagus around the same, I think it's 4th or 5th century, of a group of men feasting with loaves of bread. And the other thing is that often in these early Eucharist drawings, you don't see the cup of wine at all. It's just bread. And the last, what we call the Last Supper, it's fairly late to appear as an image where Jesus is actually sitting at the table with his disciples. And again, often the cup of wine isn't there. Sometimes it's fish and bread or something else, and sometimes the wine is there. But the moment depicted in the Last Supper story, in the most common image of the Last Supper, is not the moment where he says, "This is my body," that we usually do in the middle of the Eucharist. It's the moment when he says, "One of you will betray me." Very interesting. Do you want to add to it? As a minister?
I thought it was good that the disciple. No, that was...
I was very struck by your saying that the cross was always a resurrection sign until about the 10th century, when Irvine is the pope that evidently sent everybody on the Crusades, which is rather scary that one man had all of that power. And I'm sort of translating that as substitutionary theory for what's going on in our world. But that struck me as something that's very, very scary.
The culture of crusade.
Yes, and thank you, Mary Kay, and uses the term crusade. So, I guess my musings about this is just this feeling in the pit of my stomach. But the other thing is, you know, what forces can we bring to counteract that?
Part of the more detailed research Rita and I have been doing for our current book, Pope Urban, when he called that first crusade in 1095, didn't do it in a vacuum. So part of what the larger story is that though he catalyzed a cultural force, there were already things that had shifted in the culture of Europe or developed in the culture of Europe that made it possible for one person to say that and for everybody to follow, or for as many people, because there's a remarkable outpouring of support for Urban, and it wasn't, we would like to think preachers had that much power, but but it's not really the power of one voice. It's that there was a cultural shift. And this cultural shift in Northern Europe begins with the encounter between Mediterranean Christianity and as it moves into Saxony in the north of Germany, And there's a history there of forced conversions of the Saxons and of Christian violence against Saxons. Included cutting down the many sacred trees. And eventually, laws were passed that if you were not baptized, that was a crime punishable by death. So that was a shift, that's a fuller shift that was happening.
Ninth century.
And the Saxons were a tribal culture that were organized in tribal units with local chiefs. And they were a warrior culture because every tribe had to be prepared to, everybody in the tribe had to be prepared to fight. And the chief of the tribe was the one to whom you swore your loyalty and allegiance. So there was a culture of loyalty and a warrior culture. I won't go into the whole long explanation. This is different than an imperial culture where you have a professional army that's off at the outskirts of most of the communities fighting, and that if you're a normal citizen, you're not going to be in the army. But in a warrior culture, everybody's life is touched by the culture. As the Saxons responded to Christianity, one of the things that happened is you begin to get what one scholar calls a warrior pity culture, that the warrior who is attacked and assaulted is both honored and an occasion of pity, a feeling that the death has to be avenged. And that those who love the one who has been injured must come to the aid of the one who's been injured and kill the enemies. So this warrior culture, the whole story is even more complex than that, so I won't go into more length, but to make especially the point that you have to look at the whole cultural context in which single leaders exert as much power. And that so we have a warrior culture in many ways, not necessarily tribal culture, but a culture that has, well, we have this warrior culture, this warrior Christian culture is what has helped shape our North American culture, our U.S. culture. That's our legacy, our cultural legacy as a country dominated by the history of Northern Europe, Western Europe. And
Western Christianity.
And Western Christianity, especially in Western Europe. So the cultural contrast, the countercultures, become very important movements within a culture that is dominantly a culture of violence. We think we are in a culture that is, our dominant culture is a culture of violence. Countercultures like the reimagining community are one of the most important things we can do, but we have to not just care for one another. We have to, like our feminist foremothers in the 19th century were so clear about, we have to see ourselves as caretakers and advocates for the well-being of our nation, of our society, and of our globe, as well as our own lives and our lives with each other.
When I was growing up as a Roman Catholic boy in a Catholic school, surrounded by lots of crucifixes with blood and thorns and all kinds of wonderful things, I never quite understood the atonement theology. There's a way in the school and the church that I was raised in, that it was there, but it was never explicated completely, and lots of mixed messages, but also coming from a home that was much more liberation-oriented. So I had this kind of duality, and it wasn't until much later when I went to Episcopal Divinity School and got exposed to a lot of things about the atonement theology, not only not being necessary, but being very oppressive, that I got to see that there were lots of other people that didn't get it either. So that was really liberating, because I remember as a boy thinking, I'll eventually understand what they mean by that, and I'm really glad that I won't. but I'm left with a question still, and part of this is growing up Roman Catholic and having some good experience, and that is that I still find the crucifix with the broken and bloody body of Jesus important in some way, that I think as feminists, there's something about the violence, the death, not necessarily
Thank you. You know, one of the critiques of liberal Christianity has been that it wants Christianity without a cross. And we're not advocating that. I'll just give you an image, a set of images where I think the early church perhaps drifted toward a sort of denial of the death of Jesus in a sort of odd way. There was a constant tension in early Christianity about could God die? You know, and all the great debates are about who was Jesus and did he really die and what part of him died and all that. what would have been weird in that period is if Christianity had not claimed he was divine, because Roman emperors were made divine, and if you have a power that can stand up to the Roman emperor, it has to be a divine power. But I think that in that process, there's a kind of imperial power projected onto Jesus, and then a sort of softening or naturalizing of what really happened to him when he died, which was it was this act of state terrorism. And I don't want to forget that. So I think one of the most interesting set of images I've ever seen that actually does it all, and is therefore very powerful, is in the chapel at the University of Central America in San Salvador. And outside the doors, it says the words of Bishop Romero, if they crucify me, I will be reborn. If they kill me, I will be reborn in the hearts of my people. And when you walk into that chapel, the first thing you see is the front chancel area, and there are those famous Salvadoran painted plaques, and there's a cross in the middle, and then there are plaques of angels surrounding the cross. And the cross is a resurrection cross. It's an image of people plowing fields and teaching children, and in the lower part of the top, the vertical beam, is Archbishop Romero in his Easter vestments blessing the people. And below him sprouts a green corn plant, which in traditional Christian art would have been a palm tree, the sign of immortality. That's what you first see when you walk into that chancel, into that chapel. Then over to one side is an oil painting that's a Renaissance-style painting that shows the priests, the six priests, the Jesuits, and the two women that were assassinated by the Salvadoran government. And it's just their busts of the eight people. And above them, from about the waist up, hovers the naked torso of Jesus with a crown of thorns, wounded side. His thumbs are tied in the method of torture used by the Salvadoran military. So that's what you see right next to the image of resurrection of the assassinated bishop resurrected at Easter. When you leave, you walk out, you see across the red brick walls of the back of the chapel the Stations of the Cross. The Stations of the Cross are a series of very large, probably the size of these whiteboards, very large charcoal drawings. They look like documentaries. White, these black and white charcoal drawings that are pictures of victims of the Salvadoran military. They're mostly naked, they're young, they're women, they're men, some of them are in groups, some of them are individual. The artist drew these pictures as these people were dumped on the streets by the Salvadoran military, and they are the Stations of the Cross.
So the capacity to tell the truth about the violence that actually happens in our world, and to have our sacred spaces be spaces that witness truthfully to the kind of violence that happens, as this space that Rita just described it, is an extremely important capacity for liberation, for freedom, and for resistance. But it is never the thing that liberates, but it is part of a process. Because when we whitewash, deny, or disappear the realities of violence in the world, then we can't address them or heal them or prevent them. So the cross in that way, I think that's part of what you were getting at. But the larger work is to form a community and sustain communities of the spirit
in which such truth-telling can happen, such repair work can happen, such prophetic witness in the world can happen, so that the whole story, as Rita just said, is has the resurrection at the center.
Mm-hmm.
I think you were next.
Okay, blessings to both of you. Thank you so much for your words today.
Hi,
Jane. Hi. I had the privilege and blessing of taking a class at UTS on African-American theology taught by Denise Dunbar Perkins, who is part of the Presbyterian Church, and she is African-American and a womanist theologian. And the thing that she cautioned me against is don't speak too harshly against atonement theology, because that is so important to the African-American community. And as a white woman, I cannot even begin to understand why that is so important. So what I wonder is, how do I build that bridge? Because I've gone to black churches in the context or through this class, and it is, it's very important. The notion of being reborn and hymns about the blood of Jesus being poured upon us, and how, you know, we're saved by the grace of God because Jesus died on the cross for our sins. How do I make that connection? I mean, I'm noticing, you know, I don't see a lot of African American sisters here, and I know because I'm on the reimagining work with reimagining committees. I know that we've tried to build those bridges. I know we've done a lot to reach out to those communities, and I think we need them. We need to, you know.
Let me make a response to that by, first of all, suggesting that it helps if we can move beyond saying the African-American community to understanding that just as the white community is an incredibly diverse, multivocal community, the African-American religious experience and religious expressions and communities are diverse and multivocal. So there is not a mm-hmm. one African-American form of Christianity, even, to say nothing of other kinds of religious mixity that happens. So that, I think that, you asked how, so I'll just say that's one how, is to examine our own thinking when we think of any community of people in a block that way. The other is, and within African-American diversities, there are African-American womanist theologians who have been very crisp and clear in their mm-hmm. critique of the Doctrine of the Atonement. So to think white women have this critique, mm-hmm. black women don't have this critique, or don't resonate to this, it's not a sufficiently truthful read. Or a complex read. What Rita and I just did in this talk with a series of substitutions is we are indebted to, in part, to Dolores Williams' analysis of the atonement from a black woman's mm-hmm. experience, because she's the one who said the real problem here is surrogacy, is substitution, is one person taking on another person's work, one person suffering for another. So our work could not be heard as just an Asian American feminist analysis or a white feminist analysis, but one that's been informed by that. So then I think as a white woman, we have to, those of us who are white women who value and seek communities, women's work together that are interracial, multivocal, we have to do our own work about understanding how our identity has been structured in a way where we would even think of a person of color as someone we need. Mm-hmm. So there's, and that work is ongoing. Mm-hmm. And to ask, if we are not together, we have to say, what about this community and how we, not in a guilt-tripping way, mm-hmm. but in a consciousness-raising way, of knowing how our identities have been structured in ways that shape how we see others. Now this we I'm using is a we white feminist we. How have I been structured in my sense of identity. So come back to baptism as the need for the ongoing transformation mm-hmm. of our lives, our sense of identity, in an ever more life-embracing identity, which was at the heart of your question.
And
so
I would
thank you for your commitment.
I would propose a different set of questions to ask, mm-hmm. not how do you create a white-based institution and then reach out to other people to support your institution so you don't look
yeah.
racist.
That's what I mean by me.
This is the pattern of white liberal institutions.
Yeah.
They run their own agendas. They have their own ideas. They think they're going to save the world with those ideas. Mm-hmm. And then they go, oh, my God, we don't look right. We look racist, or there's a problem with the way we're doing this. So then they want to add the people in that will make the picture look better. Most of us aren't interested in helping a white society look good.
Mm-hmm.
It has problems. The microphone is a white microphone. So the fact is that you find the same problematic theologies that are supposedly rampant in the ethnic churches in the white church. That's why we're all fighting it.
Yeah.
But the question I would ask is, what have you done to be involved in communities where you are not the dominant person, where you are uncomfortable, and where you have to put up with things that make you wonder and challenge, but where you support other people's agendas?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, thanks for asking.
Thank you.
Last one, I think.
Or we have
yeah. one more. Okay,
maybe
we have two.
More.
We have time for two. All right.
We'll try
we'll just not talk so much. Okay.
Okay. Hello, hello?
Yeah.
This goes back to the Eucharistic question a while back. June Gowdy is another scholar who has just published a book on the early church's understanding of Eucharist. And
okay.
I can't remember the name of the title. Mary, do you know? Anyway,
we'll look at it.
It's a very fine piece of work. The other had to do with what I understand as the cult of the martyrs in the second and third and fourth century, and how that fits into the resurrection focus of the faith and all that sort of stuff. I'd love to hear your comments on that.
That's a great question because it's a tough one. okay. This is something that seems to happen in a lot of human communities, happened under the Roman Empire with unusual deaths, like martyr death. Untimely deaths, but especially very public martyr deaths. First of all, they weren't that common. The persecution that we hear about in the early church actually wasn't that frequent. And there was really only one major empire-wide persecution, but Diocletian. But the Christianity had a lot invested in those martyrs and the persecution. One of the things that seems to happen is that when these unusual deaths happen, they coalesce a certain kind of energy. And it's not just Christianity, although Christianity and Judaism seem to have innovated on the idea of martyrs. But people will take souvenirs, pieces of bone or clothing from the deceased, because somehow the coalescing of power seems to have a power around death that's important. This even happened in the U.S. in the period of lynching. People took pieces of bone and clothing from the lynched African Americans that they cheered in the lynch, as they cheered while these people died. Then they'd take home souvenirs. H.L. Mencken, in 1938, wrote a scathing editorial against this practice, because he was against lynching. But there's something about death that does that. And in a period in the early church and in the Roman Empire where everything had demonic or angelic power, I mean, everything, material objects had spiritual power,
the martyrs who stood strong for the faith, their relics were especially powerful, I think partly because they had defeated death. In other words, the relics were powerful amulets, you could say, for intercessory prayers. And it was believed that if you prayed at the place where a martyr was buried, or with a relic from a martyr, or some souvenir, or even the image, an icon of a martyr, as a lot of churches did, put them in their churches, that person was in a special elect place in paradise and had access to God that an ordinary person wouldn't have because of the faith by which they died. And so they were important intercessors for prayer. So I think I think the development of the cult of the martyrs, which is a major thing in the first 1,000 years of Christianity, it's still a major thing in Christianity, has something to do with that sensibility about a particular power of certain dead people who went on and who live again and who have gained the gift of eternal life and therefore can hear prayer and be effective intercessors.
A little lighthearted, you mentioned the dolphin as a symbol. A week from Sunday, I get to attend the confirmation of my 14-year-old granddaughter, who has an affinity for dolphins. I'd like you to tell me more.
Say some more about the dolphins.
Oh, the dolphins. Rita and I spent last summer traveling all over Italy and Turkey looking for, first of all, to see if there were any crucifixions in the early churches, and to see what the images were. And the dolphins dolphins show up everywhere. In Hagia Sophia, in St. Sophia, there's dolphin decorations on all the pillars in one section. And the dolphins were, they were also, the Roman, everybody loved dolphins. So you can tell her that. But the dolphins are sometimes viewed as they were loved partly because they interacted with human beings in a way, they were transitional creatures, you know. From the mysterious depths of the waters where they survive, they also commune or communicate with human beings. So sometimes they're viewed as a Christ figure, but as we said today, the Christian soul or the soul is viewed to be like a fish. So maybe we should give you a copy of Be Ye Like the Fish.
Because dolphins and fish were the same thing it was a category of fish.
Yeah. So it's just a very, I think it's, they have these little smiles, and they're very joyful, and they're leaping through the waves, and they just appear in places.
In the San Vitale, where I described that image of Moses untying his sandal, the main arch of the chancel has the portraits of the apostles, and by the way, one of the apostles is a saint of the church and not one of the original 12, so they felt perfectly free to substitute the people they liked. But the portraits, the bust of each apostle is framed by leaping dolphins.
Yeah. So they are a symbol of the soul in its element.
And they're usually green.
They're usually green.
Yeah. So be ye like the dolphins. Thank you.
Thank you both so much. And you're going to be at a table across from the registration table to sign books at this time. You can also go and get refreshments. And there's books for sale at the Amazon book cubicle sort of area that they're at down by the vendors. You can then be ready to go to a workshop, a caucus, a walk, what have you, at 11 o'clock. So blessings on this next half hour.
Here, I'm going to give her the one about the fish. I'm going to give it a copy. This is that text we read, that ancient text that says, can you like the fish? Granddaughter. Yeah.
got here?